Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, my name is Nathan Hobson, and I'm a host for the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast, a member of the New Books Network. Today, I'll be talking with Dr. Veronica Mack about her book, Milk Craze, Body, Science, and Hope in China, which is out from the University of Hawaii Press in 2021. Milk Craze mixes historical and ethnographic research on milk to understand the morality politics of class, labor, and identity in modern Hong Kong and the Shunde area of Guangdong. Beginning with the historical milkscapes of ancient China, Mack's book explores the influence of British colonization on dairy culture in Hong Kong, the role of governments and corporations in making China one of the world's largest producers and consumers of cow's milk, and the medicalization and moralization of practices and identities around milk, breast milk, and infant formula in contemporary Hong Kong. In doing so, Milk Craze examines topics including the demolition of indigenous cheesemaking in Shunde, the development of Hong Kong silk stocking milk tea, and the pressures created by society and pharmaceutical firms on working mothers to choose infant formula over breastfeeding. Okay, Dr. Mack, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. So I'd like to ask you how you became interested in the research project that became your book, Milk Craze. And I understand it has something to do with the ethnographic research that you were doing in Hong Kong and in the in an area of Guangdong, south of Guangzhou, the Shunde area. So I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about those two cities, how you ended up working there, and how that became the project that we're going to be talking about today.
Okay, thank you very much, Nathan, for inviting me for this very meaningful podcast. Please call me Veronica. Regarding how I come to this project, I think we need to go back to 14 years ago, that in 2008, that I started to plan my PhD thesis. A lot of things happened between 2008 to 2012. For example, 2008, there is the melanin contaminated milk, formula milk in China that caused 54,000 babies died because of the kidney stones. And also during that time in 2000, because of that, there's a huge surge in demand of the formula milk in Hong Kong. In 2010, there are many shops out of stock in Hong Kong, similar to the situation in USA recently, that the mothers cry out for help in getting the formula milk. It struck my attention to this because I still remember in 1980s that anthropologist Harris Martin, he mentioned that Chinese people are lactophobia, that Chinese people don't drink milk because they are very afraid of milk and they think that this is a very ugly liquid, some sort of these kind of comments. And then we just within 30 years that China become the second largest milk market in the world. Not only that, China also become the top five supplier of milk in the world. And in addition to that, there is also a contrary phenomenon that is I received the news about the disappearing of the indigenous Chinese cheese in Shunde, in Xinbang village, that draw my childhood memory because I used to eat the cheese produced from Daliang when I was a child. And I was quite surprised that, okay, people nowadays don't eat this kind of indigenous Chinese cheese anymore. And also usually people don't know that Chinese have indigenous cheese. But nowadays people don't care that it's disappearing. Until recently, that the Shunde government put it in under the umbrella of intangible cultural heritage, but because of boom, so as to boom tourism. But other than that, the local people in the young generation are not that much interested in the indigenous Chinese cheese. So I see that this is a contradictory trend of the growth of Western formula milk or the Western cow's milk. But on the other hand, that is a diminishing or disappearing indigenous milk culture in China. So I choose Shunde as a place to study in China. And what about Hong Kong? So Hong Kong also is a special place, although it is 2-hour drive from Shunde. However, we also have swamp buffalo used in the rice field. However, we don't have this kind of culture in producing this kind of special Chinese cheese in Hong Kong. And people, because Hong Kong used to be a fish village, and people are not that sophisticated in producing and also appreciating cheese. And at the same time, Hong Kong also have a very special history. It's the colonial history starting in 1860s. And this is the first time that with the colonists, British colonists come into Hong Kong, they have the military force, they have the missionaries, and also they import cows from Britain and also Australia, and also including the milkmaid. So this is also, that's why Hong Kong, I believe, is the earliest place in China that have that built up a local dairy farm. And starting from that, okay, it changed the history of the dietary culture of the people in Hong Kong. They have at least the rich people have chance to eat locally produced Western cow's milk, okay, and also all kind of Western cuisine, etc. So that's why I want to look into the dietary pattern, history, behavior, and also the health belief regarding milk and also milk-related products, including the Dalian cheese, and how this can tell us about globalization, capitalism, local cuisine, the indigenous culture, and also modernity. Yes.
Yeah. So thank you. That sets us up really nicely to jump into the book. And I guess I wanted to say before we started that one of the reasons I was really interested in talking to you about the book is one that sort of became an issue after we first contacted each other about doing the interview, which is the sudden formula crisis in the United States, right? And I think this is something that, you know, it's one of those things that reminds you that some of the issues that you're talking about in the book about, you know, supply and demand and about the moral choices that people are making, in addition to all the sort of interesting historical data that's in here, are very relevant today. And I hope we'll get a chance to talk about some of that as well. And I want to do this to get to that, starting with chapter one, which is Milk, Body, and Social Class in Ancient China. So here again, you're giving us a little bit of this historical background. Again, and as you say, I think it's there's a lot that, you know, as you point out, is somewhat surprising in the same way that the idea that China is the number five, I think you said, milk supplier in the world is probably quite surprising to people. This chapter is the first of three on the history of the production and consumption of modern industrialized cow milk in Hong Kong and China. And you're showing that the history of animal milks is a lot longer and more complicated than is widely believed in China. So what are the important things that we need to know about the historical milkscapes, as you put it, these landscapes of production, consumption, and the cultural associations, in order to understand the rest of the book, the modern changes that you're talking about, brought about by the British, the communists, and then post-war American food aid, et cetera?
Okay. I think the key point I want to raise is that milk used to be used as a kind of medicine, medical food, you can say it, in Asian China. So I think for the Chinese, usually people don't know that Chinese have a very long milk culture. And but you, in Chinese society, according to the Chinese medical principle, we do not separate food and medicine. So we eat food to heal our body in addition to just maintain our life. So food and medicine are very closely correlated. And also, one also important point is that there is no perfect food according to our principle, because different people have different body and different health propensity, we'll say. We call it hot and cold. So for those people, okay, for example, milk is a perfect natural food, right, in Western culture. So however, from the Chinese traditional medical perspective, okay, milk is good in general speaking, but different kind of mammals' milk are suitable for different body. For example, now we used to have cow's milk, right? Most popular milk, the globalized milk, is cow's milk. Cow's milk, according to the Chinese medical principle, is good, but it is cold. So it is good for the baby because baby is used to be have a hot, very hot body. However, for the elderly or those who have a weak body, if you drink cow's milk, it's too cold for the person. So either you need you to warm it up, or you eat other kind, you drink other kind of milk, such as goat milk, because goat milk is a little bit warmer than cow's milk. However, the best substitutes of breast milk for the baby for the babies is not cow's milk. So according to Asian Chinese test, that will be the pig's milk. So you can just a few examples to show that, first of all, okay, it is not a kind of, it's not natural to have cow's milk as a universal, natural, perfect food. Okay, according to the Chinese principle, Chinese culture have a long history and also a wide, more open, okay, to different kind of mammals' milk, to different bodies. So I think the key thing is that milk is not for everyday drink. So it is usually when the people got sick when they are, like the babies are impossible to get mother's milk. So for a short period of time, we can take the mammal's milk. So other than that, okay, Chinese people use not to take milk as a daily drink. So that is a big contrary to what people are practicing nowadays. Is that now governments are promoting, right, to have at least a glass of milk to maintain our health for different age group, okay, every day in order to get enough calcium, protein, etc. Okay, so I think this is what I want to emphasize.
Yeah, thank you. And that's, again, it's really helpful to get us to what you do in the second chapter, Dairy Farm, British Milk Tea, and Soy Milk in Milk Bottles, which is thinking about the cultural politics of food consumption, of dietary health, and of social change in Hong Kong after 1841. So as you've said, you know, unlike the mainland, Hong Kong had no indigenous culture of cow's milk production. So one of your central questions is sort of what happens to milk under British colonial rule. So the colonists are obviously sort of eager to develop and maintain stable dairy supplies for their own consumption, for their own health and enjoyment. But part of the picture that you talk about here is the industrialization of soy milk production, which I thought was quite interesting, and the development of a distinctly Hong Kong tradition of the silk stocking milk tea, which I did enjoy when I was in Hong Kong, and the contestation over not just milk, but over the sort of proper moral character of what modern Hong Kong should be and what modern Hong Kongers should be. So if I'm understanding your argument correctly here, you're saying that sort of milk and nutrition science, Western production and colonial hierarchies are together instrumental in sort of creating new moralities of food and of class and of identity in Hong Kong under British control.
Yes, I think this is a big topic. Yeah, I think I need to break down this into different layers in order to answer the questions. Yeah, definitely that the colonial history create a new musescape for Hong Kong. First of all, after the Hong Kong become British colonies, the first dairy farm was established by Patrick Benson. He was a Scottish surgery that he is very famous for being a scientist to study tropical disease. So but at the same time, he is a very successful and smart business person. So he built dairy farm, and he also established the first medical school in Hong Kong that become part of Hong Kong University. So the first one. So according to his supervision and visions about of the university, they always emphasize milk is a kind of perfect food, okay, with good nutritions, and that also start to have like after the development of dairy farm, we also at the same time have the start of the nutrition science educations in Hong Kong, and also the first survey about the health of Hong Kong people in during the 1960s, late 1960s. So you can see that the dairy farm establishment is go hand in hand with the establishment of the whole medical system in Hong Kong. And because of the milk are used to be consumed and mostly consumed by the Western people because they are more affordable, and also the supply is not that huge in the beginning. So it is almost absolutely exclusive for the foreigners. For the local people, on one hand, they don't have a habit, okay, or a culture in drinking milk every day. On the other hand, it is out of their reach, economically. But at the same time, they can see that this is a kind of symbol of the ruling class and also a kind of good nutrition, because the nutrition science is getting more and more popular. People hear, okay, from radio or other newspaper talk about the nutrition of milk. And also during the 1940s, this is the time that with a huge migrants come to Hong Kong. And talking about soil milk, I have to talk about a brand called Whiter Soil that is now globalized. And the founder is Dr. Low, and he is also a very interesting person. He was born in Malaysia and he migrated to Hong Kong. And he learned about the nutritions about soil milk. This from in a talk in Shanghai. And many people think about soy milk is a traditional Chinese food, but in fact, similar to fresh cow's milk, it is not a traditional food in Western culture as well, because fresh milk also become only popular after refrigerator become popular, but because it can turn back quickly. So similar to soy milk, so Hong Kong, Chinese people has a long history of eating soy bean curd, tofu, but not drinking soy milk. So according to Chinese principles, soy milk is rather cooling. It's not so good for the elderly, those who are weaker with body. So what Dr. Low put is trying to imitate soy milk is a kind of a product, a Chinese cow's milk that is as nutrition as the Western cow's milk. That's why he put the brand name as Whiter Soil. That's mean vitamin, good vitamin plus soil milk. And he promoted similar to our cow's milk. For example, the bottle is an imitation of the milk bottle when he sell it. And also, he also organized home delivery similar to the cow's milk. So, however, in the beginning, the sales is not good, because Chinese people still don't have a habit of drinking Western milk, so they don't have a habit of drinking soy milk as well. So after several phases of promotions, until I would say the 90s, almost to 1970s, the Whiter Soil milk has become really popular. But during the whole, I would say that the whole 30 years, they are just so growing slowly. But this is the kickoff of industrialization. It's very much stimulated by Western science, not only nutrition science, but also bottling. The science of bottling the sawmill into a bottle. And Dr. Lo borrowed it from the soft drink, the technology from soft drink. And the soy milk compared with the cow's milk, people have a perception is that cow's milk is more superior because this is from the Western society. And it is also they are more, those who understand Western science, okay, nutrition science, have more findings, okay, they got more information about the milk rather than soy milk. So they still have a hierarchy that cow's milk are better than soy milk. And soy milk, according to Chinese principle, as I mentioned, is too cooling for some sort of people, but it seems that the Western cow's milk are more all-rounded, okay, for the people. And also in the, I talk about in the book of Cha Chan Teng, because of the people now, they accept cow's milk is good. And Dairy Farm is the first cow's milk farm in Hong Kong and also in China. It become very famous. And also it have a sort of symbolic meaning related to the ruling class. So in the Cha Chan Teng, the local tea cafe, they have very interesting hierarchy of milk inside the menu. Okay, the top one will be fresh cow's milk that was branded with Dairy Farm. Okay, second is other cow's milk, okay, fresh cow's milk from other brand. And then you have a kind of milk that can be produced from diluting from condensed milk, a kind of milk drink. So this is the lowest tier. So you can see that, okay, even within the a kind of milk drink, so you can see the hierarchy that Dairy Farm, okay, symbolize, okay, a kind of ring class Britishness. They occupy the top positions, okay, in this milk hierarchy compared to the rest. And regarding, okay, other questions like the Hong Kong still stock milk tea, okay, another my specialties. Yeah, I also study milk tea. It is a kind of product. You can say that a copycat about the British milk tea, but this is different. As per my understanding, okay, British milk tea is usually produced from usually the black tea. Okay, we boil the black tea, and then we add milk and fresh milk and sugar. So this is also the kind of way to produce in the hotels. Okay, in the early, I think it's before the 2000s. But in recently, even hotel, they have two versions, the British milk tea and the Hong Kong style milk tea, because Hong Kong style milk tea getting more and more popular, even in hotel. The Hong Kong style milk tea is a sort of bottom up, I would say, that is developed in Dai Pai Dong, that the street food, that they use more than six type of tea mixed together, okay, ranging from very coarse one to the powder of the tea. the story goes like that is that because the tea produced from the whole leaf is so expensive. So those who want to be more economical, they cut the price, they use different kind of tea to mix together, make it as very strong. And they use a technique that they put it They soak it, and then they boil it, and then they pull it several times, at least eight times, okay, in order to get the aroma out and make it very strong. And then they add the condensed milk, not the fresh milk, making a kind of very unique taste. And now it becomes Hong Kong local culture, not local, I think Hong Kong level intangible cultural heritage as well, because of the very special six-step technique in producing it. So for this, you can see that, okay, the creation of the Hong Kong style still stocking beauty is also a kind of reference to the British prestigious beauty. Because in the beginning, the British Western restaurant don't allow the Chinese people to go inside to enjoy the food. I have read one of the annual reports in Dairy Farm. They also operate restaurants. They don't allow the Chinese people to go into the restaurant during the 1940s to 50s. So that's the reasons that they have the local Chinese people operate the local cafe and also restaurants selling Western style food. And also they start selling British milk tea and later also the Hong Kong style milk tea as well. Okay, so you can, so from this we can see the whole culture, the food culture reflect a kind of the ruling class and the ordinary people. And we can see this kind of habit, okay, is trickling down, but with localizations. And this reflects Hong Kong people's social class and identity. And in recent year, Hong Kong now faced a lot of social change. And young people have given new meaning to local culture, including beauty. So that will be another book to talk about it.
Yeah. And I think this is, you've touched on these questions that I think are really central to the book of food, class, identity, hybridization. And it's sort of interesting how milk is functioning in some ways as a functional good and in other ways as a sort of prestige good, and how the dynamics of that prestige and how the sort of polarity of identity is shifting back and forth between, you know, here it represents high class British culture, here it represents a sort of bottom up, authentic Hong Kong identity. And we come back to, you know, some of these same issues, less, I think, with identity and more with the sort of morality questions in the last chapters of the book. But before we do that, we shift gears back to the Chinese mainland in chapter three, Global Capital, Local Culture, and Food Uncertainty. So this chapter has two parts. In the first half, you're sort of following the struggles of water buffalo milk producers in Sunda during the modernization programs of the communist government. In the second half, you're looking at the effects of globalization on milk production and consumption. As I understand it, a key argument here is that we need to look for the causes of dietary change in China in, as you put it, quote, the alliance between corporations and the Chinese national state, rather than a sort of more general natural dietary transition, if you will, spurred on by economic growth or accompanying lifestyle change. A key word you use here, and I'm not going to get the pronunciation right, is buping, I guess, so nourishing product. And maybe it makes sense to start our conversation about this chapter here, because this seems like a sort of anchoring word to think about the sort of mechanisms and problems of China's sort of turn to milk.
Okay, so maybe I explain this word. Buping is means to a kind of nurturing product that can consume occasionally. So this is a kind of concept from the traditional Chinese medicine, that when you are get weak, you become weak or sick, you can take in some food to boost your energy. I think for the questions of the dietary change in China, you have pointed out very clearly is that exactly what I want to say is that usually when I read other articles and books on talking about the Chinese people are drinking so much milk, they usually point to, oh, they are now driving Mercedes, they are having Gucci and Prada, now they have economic growth, and that is natural for them because now they are wealthy, they can have the food that is, or enjoy life that is good, and that is Western, that is high quality, give them health, etc., etc. So it seemed to be at hand, we have also a term like nutrition transition, right? It seemed to be an evolution that those who have no milk, now they are wealthy, so now they should have more milk. So I want to, point out is that Chinese have a long culture of using milk, okay? So it is nothing new for them. But in the past, it's more like a kind of occasional medicine or like poopy, that you drink it occasionally. So Chinese people have other kind of food that can provide good nutrition, calcium, protein. We have a lot of sunshine, green leaves, etc. So we do not necessarily have to drink cow's milk. Okay? So that is the point. And however, what really drive the people demand in milk start only after 1997, okay? That Mengniu and Yili, the two largest milk producers in China, that they have established and they have increased in productions. So that is, I would say, I will come from a more political economy approach to analyze this, is that the production drive consumptions. So for example, in Mengniu's cases, they do not really have a factory to produce milk before they launch a huge marketing campaigns, driving people to eat ice cream and also to drink milk. And then once they have the name being known, they have they team up with they outsource the productions to other factory. And once they got more orders, they line up with their partners to do that. Until to a certain stage that they got big enough to have their own factory. Okay, so you can see that they do marketing and promotion to create demand before they really have the productions. So this is the and the key selling point is low price and good nutrition. So and the government welcome this kind of economic activities because it can bring economic benefits to the local people, employment, boom up resources, foreign investment, as well as taxation to the government. And this is also the direction, this part of China's dream, I would say, that's the that they put a lot of, they changed the policy that make it like the launch of the product can be easier. They lower the standard about milk, etc. So that, and they allow them to outsource all the production to the farmers. They employ third party as checking point. And then, in fact, Mengniu and Yili main job is do marketing. So they outsource all the productions to other suppliers. So, and also that is the reasons for the later problem about the food safety issues about the milk. So this is so that is my main argument, is that we need to pay attention to the collaborations between the government and also for the corporations. And the aim is to increase the benefits and GDP. Yeah, it is not so much about the natural transitions of the people that they demand, okay? They want to have, of course, I'm not denying that the people also receive information, knowledge about Western science. But if there is not so much supply of milk that at such a low price, the demand will not be boom up so quickly.
Yeah, so what was interesting to me here is, you know, thinking about that sort of, you know, governmental promotion of milk is that, you know, it does, as you say, argue against this sort of standard dietary transition rhetoric, which we hear a lot. And it's something that gets talked about a great deal, is the sort of natural progression, right? And I found this very interesting that you're sort of picking apart that, you know, whenever we hear that word natural, we should always be suspicious. And I appreciated your suspicion there, right? So chapters 4 and 5, I think in my mind, sort of form a separate part of the book. It's not a clear delineation here, but this is where you're looking at, bottle feeding as love, success and citizenship, chapter 4, and pharmaceutical nexus, creating illness and giving hope. You're looking at the morality politics, I think, and the sort of business of infant feeding, right? So we're talking about the problem of infant formula versus breast milk, of bottle feeding versus breastfeeding in China and Hong Kong. And the popularity of formula is in Hong Kong today is quite a far cry from the sort of moral prohibition against bottle feeding a century ago. And this, at first blush, at least to me, sort of ran counter to the current trend toward breastfeeding in the contemporary West. But what does this view of the present, my view of the present, miss or misconstrue about the environment in which families make these decisions? And what do these choices say about the moral landscape of decisions about work, about nutrition, about child rearing, and about the moral and class politics of infant feeding? And then as you talk about in chapter five, also the way that Big Pharma has led this sort of medicalized discourse about breast milk versus formula, which is the core of that chapter. And this sort of very interesting creation of this idea of, quote, insufficient milk syndrome and also picky eating syndrome. So I think it makes sense in from my end to think about the two chapters together. If you'd like to talk about them separately, that's fine too.
Okay. I think I would like to add a little bit about the role of the government. I think government also play a very important role. Okay, I think it's not only in Hong Kong, but globally in promoting milk. Think about the nutrition pyramid, right? That is a special category that you have to drink a certain kind of milk every day. So I think I'm not the first person, right? I think Professor Nesney also point out the food politics. She point out the politics about the formulations of the food pyramid in USA. That is also a kind of collaborations between the government and the dairy farm associations. So the dairy association. And similarly, okay, because of the very, we look upon the U.S. nutrition pyramid as a kind of blueprint, okay, a kind of model for other countries to follow. Similar to Hong Kong, okay, the nutrition scientists very much follow the nutrition pyramid. And especially when I study those in China, and they also exactly the same. But they also put the soy milk, okay, as a substitute of the cow's milk. But still cow's milk, as I mentioned, still have a higher status than soy milk in Chinese society because of the reasons that I explained it. And so if the government already sets this kind of nutrition directions, so it's this kind of moral obligations, especially for the mother, to follow in order to make sure that her family, including herself, her son or her husband, okay, or the daughters, can have good body, okay, in order to, so that to make sure that they have intake of sufficient nutritions through milk. And for that, okay, talking about the decisions of drinking milk, okay, regarding to work, and also the role of the big pharmaceutical company playing in marketing the milk to their family. Okay, I will talk about some of the social contests in China and Hong Kong is that one of the very key thing about how the pharmaceutical company market these products in Chinese society is to emphasize on education. So one may wonder why drinking formula milk is related to education. I find there's a big difference of the way how the pharmaceutical company market formula milk in Western society and in Chinese society. In Chinese society, no matter in Hong Kong or in China, they emphasize on one of the hero nutritions called DHA. So that is good for the brain development, eye development, okay? So for the one of the top selling brand is called Mead Johnson. So Mead Johnson sell their product with the unique selling message in Hong Kong and China is that they have the 8 times more DHA than other brand. So why DHA is so important? It's one of the omega-3 proteins that allowed the it is proven that it's good for the brain. However, they hide the fact that the breast milk in fact have more DHA than the formula milk. Okay, nobody mentioned it. Okay, not only in advertisement, but also in mass media. So seldom people talk about breast milk have more DHA. But at the same time, in the advertisement, they emphasize that drinking formula milk can help the language ability, okay, the creativity, the emotions, and also the motion of the baby. So they have certain indirect, they have some support about it, but I think the association is very indirect. So however, in the whole advertisement, it gives the mother's image is that, okay, you drink this kind of almond milk, you can have developed a all-round baby that can be successful in interview. So in some sorts of, a few advertisements, you can see that there are, the storyline goes that the baby is drinking the milk and then they go to the interviews in a prestigious kindergarten and then they have to raise their hands and they answer all the questions correctly after drinking the milk. So it's sort of, I think it's just exaggerated, okay, the benefits. But that is the problem of the loophole of the advertising regulations that allow the former milk company to create this kind of hope or dream or illusions to the mothers who are experiencing so much stress in Chinese society. Because how do the kids perform directly affect the face, not only the mother, but the family. So this is also what I put in my book, to talk about the stress the mother face, okay, and also the mother usually have her own career in Hong Kong. The employment rate of the woman in Hong Kong is very high, and so many of the women play a double role as both a mother and a worker. And in regarding the work ethic in Hong Kong and also in China, is that the whole culture glorify the mother can return to work after giving birth to the baby within a few weeks. So for example, we see celebrities, okay, to promote herself in the social media that there's a special recipe that you eat and then you can give birth and you keep slim within a few days. So there is some of the formula milk they try to sell to the mother that, okay, you drink this kind of formula instead of eating other kind of traditional Chinese food, so you can slim your bodies once you give birth. So this is another way to sell milk, okay, to the mother-to-be. And so the mother, okay, in order to have this kind of work, and I would say that it's under a highly capitalist city that they want the labor to be returned to work as quick as possible, okay? So this whole working ethnos, okay, can push the mothers to drink formula milk as a way to slim up the body, and also at the same time can give enough nutrition to the babies. And after she gives birth, okay, it's good to give formula milk to the babies in order to have he or she to go to prestigious kindergarten. So this is the whole idea of why formula milk are getting so popular. And at the same time, they are selling, giving out message is that the mother need to be very careful about her diet if you want to breastfeed. For example, I find this particular disturbing in the handbook of the nutrition guideline in China. So there's not much, in Hong Kong, the government and also many of the hospital emphasize on breastfeeding. However, in China, I see the guidebook is that although there are a lot of breastfeeding-friendly hospitals in China, however, put into practice, when you read the guidebook about the nutrition association supported by the government, you find that there's a number of points that the woman need to pay special care. For example, if she doesn't have enough sunshine, if she doesn't intake enough vitamin K, etc., so the baby probably won't have enough nutrition through breastfeeding. And also, they changed the idea of weaning, is that after 6 months, the mother should not breastfeed. Instead, she need to feed the baby with formula milk. That is quite different from what Unicell is selling, that the baby should have the right to have the breast milk, okay, as long as he or she like, okay, beyond 2 years. So this is sort of very big difference. In the case of Hong Kong, this is although the government do promote breastfeeding, this is more like the work ethno I mentioned, that the mothers don't have sufficient support because we only have 4 weeks holiday, 6 weeks holiday after she give birth to the babies. So there's not sufficient time for the mother to breastfeed. Okay, so usually mother give up breastfeeding after 6 months. Six weeks. Okay, so that is the problem about the mother's breastfeeding. So, and also they still receive so much stress to produce milk that they create a kind of insufficient milk syndrome that's quite popular among my informants. There are a lot of special recipe telling the mother what kind of food she can eat in order to increase the milk. But many of these kind of recipes are very fatty. I would say the women are so scared. Oh, I need to have this kind of a tough sandwich before I go to bed in order to have sufficient milk so I will get fat very easily. So the mothers are very worried about the body shape. And they have become so stressful under this kind of working at nose. So they give up breastfeeding easily because they can easily say that, okay, I don't have enough milk. Okay. I think the problem is not about the mothers being selfish. It's more about the whole social structure. I would say that the support of the organization and sometimes of the family. I have many informants told me that the husband feels suspicious that whether his wife has sufficient milk to feed the baby. And I still can remember that I breastfeed my babies. And they're so rare people willing to breastfeed in public that after 10 years I breastfeed, the cafe manager can still remember I breastfeed in that cafe. So this is a whole culture and a kind of environment that not so much welcome the woman to breastfeed, especially in public. Talking about the picky eating syndrome, so this is another kind of, I would say that the pharmaceutical company construct diseases. Although this is included in the psychological DSM handbook, is a kind of picky eating syndromes. However, this is the syndrome that very much picked up by the pharmaceutical company to emphasize that and also exaggerated in the advertisement, saying that, okay, if your children don't have sufficient nutrition because they are picky, they probably cannot perform well in school. So in the advertisement, similarly, okay, you can see that there's a blackboard, there's examinations, there's a room, the children are getting very bored about the schools, and they are sleepy, and they are not paying attention because they're being picky eater. So, however, one need to note that because in Hong Kong and China, people are getting wealthy, and the children are snacking all the time. So many children are being picky because they eat too much. So traditionally speaking, the Chinese people, according to Chinese traditional medical principle, in case of children being too much picky eater, the medical doctor will advise the kids to eat less. Okay. However, on the contrary, okay, in the advertisement of pharmaceutical company, they promote they to drink more picky eating milk that are super nutritious. So there is a vigorous cycle, is that if the kids, okay, they already snack throughout the day and they drink the super nutritions and also carbohydrates and protein-rich formula milk, they will get even more full before their proper meal time. So they will become even more picky. So that's why Consumer Council in Hong Kong has already advised mothers or the parents or the caretaker not to give the kids picky eating formula in such a case because this is not necessary and may make them the syndrome even worse. So however, I want to point out is that this kind of illness are sort of indirectly created in order to sell more product. So that's the point.
Yeah, and it's, again, it sort of gets to the analysis that you're doing over all of these sort of, you know, milk as a socially embedded product and a set of sort of practices and looking at the different actors, whether it's states, corporations, individuals, and how that plays out in terms of questions about identity and class, which I think run through the entire book. we're getting to, so we've reached the end of the book, but you did mention earlier that there was, you know, maybe another book project out there when we were talking about one of the earlier chapters, and it makes me wonder what you're working on now that the book is out.
As an extension of the book, I didn't have room in my book to talk about the farm review for the elderly. So I have written papers, general papers already published about elderly, okay, and how the farm real company, because not to mention, I mentioned, right, that Chinese people only drink milk within these 30 years. So for the elderly, throughout their life, they never get in touch with the milk until they retired. So at the age of 70s or above. So I'm interested, how come the farmer company can promote, in what way they can promote the milk to the elderly who should have a very constant diet, right? So how can they make them change the diet to drink milk every day by promoting elderly milk? So I have written papers about the marketing on elderly milk, about selling another chapters going to be published in another book about they sell through the nutrition science, about the marketing. And also I have an extension about milk tea. Because milk tea now have been recent year that has been being picked up to be the name of a milk tea alliance. So this is a kind of pan-Asian young people's a kind of protest. So I already published papers about why they pick up the name milk tea for the young, why the people in Asia, although they have all in this Thailand, Vietnam, Burma, Hong Kong, Taiwan, all have milk tea, but very different milk tea. So how the whole story, so it's regarding popular culture, social media, online digital protests, etc. So this is an extension, about milk tea. And also for another, I'm going to study another food products. So this is outside milk. So that will be mushroom. So that is my upcoming project about mushroom.
Oh, really? Why mushrooms? And what specifically are you interested in?
It's because I not only about food, I also study heritage, right? So first of all, milk, in Dalian is a kind of indigenous heritage cheese. I'm interested in mushroom because I think mushroom is the future food, not only as a kind of food, but it can also solve the global problem about pollutions. And because it can purify water and also soil and air. But at the same time, it doesn't have any carbon footprint in the process of productions in the agriculture. And also, I studied the field site will be in Zhejiang, Qingyuan. So this is the place that Buddha in China. This is the place, this is the first time the human cultivated the mushroom. So it is in China. People used to think that it is in Japan. So that's why mushroom, the Chinese, is called shiitake, right? Shiitake. So it's Japanese word. However, we have proved in recent years, starting in 1987, we are Professor Zhang. He come from the same university with me, the university I study. So he has already proven that it is from China. In fact, it's from China. So I go to the place that the first, long in the human history, that the first time human able to cultivate the mushroom. But it is not totally human artificial cultivated. It is in the forest. So they cut the bark of the trees and then just let the mushroom to grow. Okay, so it is a kind of semi-artificial. So this kind of technique is already become the heritage. And the whole the forest and the mushroom ecological system, cultivation system, was also listed by FAO and UNESCO as the globally important agricultural cultural system. So I plan to go there this summer. But because of COVID, it's very difficult to get a ticket. So I may go there in the next summer. So I'm starting working on this now.
No, that sounds fascinating, and I will be looking forward to reading about mushrooms as well as milk when your papers on that come out. And thank you for taking some time to talk with us today about your book, about milk craze. It was a pleasure.
Okay, thank you very much, Nathan.
Yep, thank you.